ascoltando i podcast di Radio Bue, la web radio degli studenti dell'Università di Padova, www.radiobue.it.
Hello there, and welcome to Short Science, your 80s-themed portal for all the very best science in brief. I'm Elizabeth Hawke.
And I'm Emma Berger. Coming up on today's show, the latest science and health stories in news in brief. I'll be looking at public engagement with science in Capsule Science, and in Capsule Medicine, Elizabeth will be looking at how information from drug trials is evaluated to make decisions about new treatments.
Plus, in our guest slot this week, we'll be hearing again from Dr. Paul Evans, this time about how he went about publicising the results of his heart study.
All that will be coming up on today's show, along with our brand new quiz and some more science trivia for you to fathom out at home.
This is Short Science.
So last week we were talking about the prevalence of heart disease headlines and stories in the media.
And so we thought we'd take some time to consider the broader concept of evaluating and reporting scientific breakthroughs and discoveries, and that's both in relation to science and health.
Now, frequent listeners will know all about our fantastic website. The address is www.shortscience.co.uk. If you've never checked it out, it is worth a look, if only for the fabulous 80s stylings.
But stylings aside, there is also a lot of useful information to be found there. Now, you can find out what's coming up on the show, listen again to a show that you might have missed or really liked, and you can also subscribe to the podcast or listen to that online via our handy podcast page.
Plus, you can send in your profile for everyone to take a look at and even have your very own Capsule Science to tell people about your science.
Now, we're very interested in what you think about science or indeed about Short Science, so send us an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk for a mention on the show, and if there's some burning question that you'd like us to try and answer, drop us a line. Now, you can also request a Capsule Science or medicine topic or volunteer to come along and be a guest on the show.
Now, before we get going properly with the show, it's time to flag up a science event for this week.
Yes, so this week it's the 1001 Inventions Exhibition at the Science Museum in South Kensington.
Sounds intriguing. What's it about?
Well, 1001 Inventions traces the forgotten story of 1,000 years of science from the Muslim world, from the 7th century onwards. Now, it features many interactive exhibits, displays and dramatisations, and the exhibition explores the shared scientific heritage of diverse cultures and looks at how many modern inventions can trace their roots back to Muslim civilization.
And more details will be available on our website events page at www.shortscience.co.uk/science-events, all one word. Now, this exhibition is completely free and runs until April, so you've plenty of time to fit in a quick visit.
It's time now for a quick mention to one of our listeners, Samantha, listening in London. Now, she asked, she'd been listening to the podcast and wondered why she wasn't getting the music. Now, it's important, if you are interested in the 80s music and you like dancing around your living room while you listen to a bit of science, you need to listen via the Listen Again link on our website at www.shortscience.co.uk, and then you'll get the full hour-long show with the music. If you're not that bothered about the music and you just want a quick bit of science while you're doing the ironing or something, then you can go for the podcast, which is slightly shorter at around half an hour. So I hope that's cleared that up, and I hope you're enjoying the show, Samantha. Now, it's time for this week's Science News in Brief.
What might aliens look like?
Mental illness, not necessarily mental.
Pretty light shows cellular mechanisms.
Cell surfing responsible for viral spread.
Our first news snippet today is about what alien life forms may actually look like. Now, with countless planets, solar systems and galaxies out there, there are an infinite number of possibilities about what kind of life we might encounter if it actually exists elsewhere. Now, if you're thinking science fiction, life not on Earth is probably not portrayed by human actors, so it's very likely not human-shaped with slightly different ears.
So what do scientists think aliens might look like then?
Well, astronomers and biologists out there have been making educated guesses about what extraterrestrial life may look like. Now, if we find life within our own solar system, it will probably follow a similar biochemistry to life on Earth, but will remain on a small scale, meaning life would probably be things like microbes and bacteria, with the largest forms of life being similar to worms. They think that Europa, a moon belonging to Jupiter, could possibly have a large ocean of water where life could exist.
So that's why they're always looking for water as a possibility that life could be there.
Well, as we know, water is essential to life and in our biochemistry, but other than the Earth in our solar system, places are usually too hot or too cold for water to exist in liquid form. So scientists are actually looking at biochemistry chemistry that could occur in substances other than water, such as sulfuric acid.
Well, fascinating stuff. The first health story today is the news that an overly Western approach can seriously skew ideas about mental illness around the world.
What do you mean by a Western approach to mental illness?
Well, most of our theory about mental illness, including nomenclature, terminology, and treatment protocols, comes from America. And some might add, comes from the American pharmaceutical industry.
So, but if they know the most about mental illness, what's the problem with that?
Well, that kind of assumes two things. Firstly, that the information, the very theory, is actually legitimate. And by that I mean untainted by commercial concerns. And there's quite a bit of debate about this point. Many people feel that the American pharmaceutical industry has had far too much involvement in the development of disease classification and treatment protocols. Now, the second assumption is that mental illness is the same everywhere around the world.
Well, that can't possibly be true, really. I mean, there must be cultural influences impacting the expression of the illnesses, let alone the illnesses themselves.
That's right. And in fact, in many cultures, mental illness is not experienced as a psychological phenomenon. It may not manifest with emotional, mood, or psychological symptoms at all. In fact, in Nigeria, depression is often described as a feeling of pepper in the head. And Salvadorian women have been known to describe post-traumatic stress disorder as a feeling of intense heat affecting the whole body.
Well, it sounds like we really need to think again about the whole concept of mental illness. So next up, new breakthroughs in synthetic biology, a field where biological systems can be created that behave in a required way. Here, researchers from San Diego have programmed cells to synchronise oscillating signals.
Okay, what are oscillating signals?
Well, oscillations are important for hormone release, sleep patterns, and other sort of on-off functions. This system that the researchers created switches a fluorescent protein on and off with the oscillation so that the system can be easily observed working when the lights flash up or are off. So another gene placed in the system conveys a signal throughout the cells so that the cells are in sync, and when one cell is turned on, they all turn on and vice versa.
So what are the implications of this?
Well, this kind of system could be used to trigger release of the hormone insulin in diabetics at regular intervals, or could be used to distribute other medication at regular intervals, or it could be used to replace other dysfunctional oscillating systems.
That sounds like a really promising development. And finally today, viruses may have developed a very clever way of accelerating around the body, looking for uninfected cells to infect.
How do they manage that then?
Well, when viruses enter a cell, they leave a protein marker on the cell surface, which tells other virus particles that this cell is taken. It's rather like when you run into the ladies and find a long line of doors with a little red engage sign showing.
So what's the significance of this finding?
Well, it's thought that this goes some way to explaining how fast viruses can spread around the body. By not wasting time trying to enter and infect cells that are already infected, each virus particle is pushed towards an uninfected cell and has the potential to wreak as much havoc as the next virus particle.
That's well-organised little critters.
Indeed. Now, any comments or questions about any of our news today, you know what to do. You can send us an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk. Now it's time for Capsule Science. So, today, Emma is thinking about some of the different aspects of public engagement with science.
Indeed. Now, the first question we need to ask ourselves is why we, the public, need to engage with science. I mean, surely the scientists out there just do their thing and we get our medical treatment or our iPod or some cute nature documentaries, right? Well, Elizabeth's going to talk about how the public interact with health services, but there is much more science out there than just health.
OK, so when do we actually interact with science as the public?
Well, there are several different stages of our lives when we interact with science in basic ways, and also different ways we use, think about, and can even, dare I say it, enjoy science. Now, I don't know what you think, Elizabeth, but I actually think that one of the reasons we're having this conversation is that science doesn't have the glossy image that some other areas of life have.
I have to say, I disagree with that, because I think science does have a very glossy image. I think that makes it unapproachable and unattainable to people. I think it sort of makes it seem sort of so special that unless you know about it, it's not something that really you should be thinking about.
Yeah, that's a good point there. Now, one of the first places you encounter science, though, in its sort of science box is in education.
Okay, stop you there. What do you mean by science box?
Well, as a preschool age child, that's when everything is really science. At that point in life, you know nothing about how things work, so you try out everything, you do experiments. Once you get to school, you're suddenly taking science lessons at the scheduled hour, and you're often being told why things are, rather than actually finding out for yourself.
So do you think this is a pretty essential time for children, and how they're going to view science in the future then?
Well, it is a very formative time, and often if a child gets the idea that science is boring, that's going to be quite hard to change. And it's often bemoaned that in these times of health and safety, schools aren't really doing any practical science, which is pretty much the best bit, really. Not that I'm advocating blowing up school science labs or anything.
Which, of course, I might have done a little bit of in my time. Of course not. Okay, but it comes to a bit of a vicious circle, though, because you need good scientists who are also inspirational to teach kids and make them want to pursue a scientific career.
Well, there you have it. You want scientists to come around with their achievements and inspire the next generation to aim for even more. And that's really why it's important for scientists to engage with the public and let it be known what they're achieving. But here there's two main problems, really.
Okay, so what are these problems?
Well, one is that science is actually so complex these days. You need people that are really good at communicating what's going on. Because often when you're working at such a complex level, many people don't have the ability to boil it down quite simply for others. And the second is how it's communicated. Now, as we're talking about fairly extensively today, media coverage of science is varied in its tone. Don't get me wrong, there are fantastic science communicators out there, but if you were to look at certain publications, you would be almost forgiven for assuming that scientists were a bunch of liars, political weapons, manipulators, and dangerous psychopaths with no regard for ethics or morals.
And it can all get very bogged down in politics these days, can't it? I mean, there's the whole Professor David Nutt thing, the government drugs advisor who recently got controversially sacked for saying that certain drugs were less harmful than alcohol.
Yeah, and in current debate, it's being discussed just what the role of science is in today's society, whether it should stick to raw facts and data, or whether it should be politicians who decide on how the research is put to use, focusing on morals and ethics.
OK, so once we're past education, and if we're not scientists, how and why do we then interact with the whole world of science?
Well, firstly, science is all about the world we live in. So even if we don't think about it, we are using science all the time. I mean, every time we go to the kitchen, we're doing chemical reactions. And don't get me started on all the technology we use. I mean, I have a degree in biochemistry, but I'm actually pretty useless on physics and engineering things sometimes. So I really have no idea how sometimes my computer works or my iPod. And that really scares me quite a lot, because we're all very reliant on technology we have no idea how to work, other than on a very superficial level. And we really have to rely on very few people in the world who really know what they're doing. However, I do know quite a lot about what's going on in my body or, say, in a plant, which many people won't know.
So I guess that's why it's important that we all have some semblance of scientific know-how. But how do we get that?
Well, there are many publications out there aimed at the average person with an interest in science, such as New Scientist magazine and others. There are also programmes now looking to engage the public with science, including the Wellcome Trust. And often universities have professors in charge of bridging that gap between what happens there and the public understanding of that. So these include Professor Jim Al-Khalili at the University of Surrey and Marcus de Sautoy at the University of Oxford. And they all write books, do radio shows and television shows. And those are also big media for science communication to the public. And we've also had several students from the Science Media Production and Science Communication programmes here at Imperial, and they've been here on Short Science, and hopefully they will be our future science reporters with maybe a balanced view. And just look at Elizabeth here, a former Science Media Production student, bringing you science information here on Short Science.
Indeed, well, I do my best. Anyway, some fascinating insights there, Emma, so thank you very much. Now, if you have any questions about anything that Emma has just been telling us, or if you'd like to suggest a Capsule Science topic for another week, then please get your laptop open, your typing fingers poised, and send us an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk. Now, just before the show, Emma was telling me about something she read in the paper this morning, something about some controversy over A-level biology.
That's right. Now, if you read the papers, you'll have seen there's a big Facebook campaign from A-level biology students because they've recently taken a paper, and they say that a lot of the questions weren't really to do with the stuff they'd learned on the syllabus. Now, education is a big thing about science learning and what have you. And these students have said, you know, oh, the stuff's not on the syllabus. And that is pretty frustrating for A-level students that need their grade to get into university. But it does provoke a debate about what science learning is really about. Is it about learning facts and regurgitating them? Or is it about how we handle data and how we interact with experimental things? So it's really a big question.
Yeah, so these students, they're complaining because they wanted a paper where they could regurgitate facts that they'd learnt, pieces of science that they knew off by heart. And what they were faced with was a paper that asked them to think about scientific concepts and maybe work out things that they hadn't thought about before. Is that the point?
Yeah, I think so. Quite a lot of that stuff. And I think also they were cross because some of the things they said they wouldn't be required to necessarily know, even though they'd probably covered it, but that it was said they weren't required to know it on the syllabus. And I guess it's really about whether or not exams should rigidly stick to the syllabus. It's just a very difficult question, really.
So it's the whole concept of science in a box, as you're saying. Is science something that is just laid out there and you have to stick to it and learn A, B and C, pass an exam, and then you are a scientist or you have a qualification? Or is it about actually a way of thinking and a way of approaching the world? So it's all very interesting stuff. Now, before we hear a bit more from our guest, Dr. Paul Evans, who we had on the show last week, talking about his study that showed that a compound found in broccoli can actually help to prevent heart disease, we thought we'd take a quick look at the papers this morning and see if there was any particularly good or bad examples of science communication. So, Emma, why don't you start us off? What have you seen?
Yep, I have been looking at the papers, and the first thing that jumped out at me was a double-page spread from the Daily Express with the headline, "What a climate con!" exclamation mark.
Okay, so startling headline, grabbed your attention.
Yep,
was
really,
there a lot of
really
science in that
attention.
Article to back it up?
Well, they say they've been looking around at different...
looking around, really technical meta-analysis of the data.
Things. They've basically got a load of headlines which are supposedly myths they are debunking, like polar bears dying and increasing temperatures and that we've had a harsh winter and so clearly the Earth isn't warming and blah, blah, blah. Now, I can't really find much data or statistics in there. You know, I think I've been looking fairly thoroughly. So I can't find much of that. And it's all, it is all just a bit political, isn't
it? So have they presented any evidence on either side of the argument for whether climate change is real or is a con? Or have they just gone for a kind of emotive...
It seems pretty emotive to me. I can't really see any hard evidence that they presented on either side of the fence, really.
Okay, well, let's move on then to my story. Now, I had the pleasure, when we divvied out the papers this morning, of tackling the Sun. And there was pretty much one story that had any relevance to science or health in the entire paper.
You do really have to trawl the papers to find science reporting. It's true.
They were quite hidden away today. And this story has the headline, 100 junkie babies born each month, legacy of mums hooked on heroin during pregnancy. So obviously quite attention-grabbing headline. And they do back up their statement about 100 junkie babies with a few statistics. A total of 1,233 cases, 102 per month reported in the last year, compared to only 751 in 1998. They don't say where those statistics come from. They just say obtained by the Sun.
Ooh,
possibly
well, there
by,
you go.
I don't know what kind of methods. And it is quite, I'd say for the Sun, it's quite a balanced article. I mean, they explain about what a junkie baby is. So it's a baby born to a mother who's hooked on a class A narcotic such as heroin or crack during pregnancy.
There you go, definition.
Yeah, so it's definition. They do a little breakdown and tell you about different areas of England, and the worst hit area was the northwest with 168 cases per month. 168 cases overall. And they have this very interesting sort of subheading with a little picture of a cute baby. My girl tried to rip out her eyes. Ex-junkie April Paget, 22, gave birth to daughter Carmella 17 months ago while addicted to the heroin substitute methadone. And the baby suffered terrible withdrawal symptoms, including trying to claw out her own eyes. But I have to say, a lot of babies claw at their faces. And it's not intentional because they're hooked on junk. It's just because that's what babies do. And they seem to think that it's the junky nature that required her to wear scratch mitts rather than being a baby.
Yeah, it's fairly emotive though, isn't it? I mean,
it is.
Most science reporting does tend to be quite emotive.
Cute picture of a baby and all that.
Yeah.
But anyway, so moving on, what was your story?
Well, my last story is from The Guardian, and it is a response. So this is from a scientist who has had, who's clearly had a story written about their whatever they're doing, and it's actually about badger extermination. So apparently someone wrote that this badger extermination was for purely economic purposes, and we're all keen to kill nature when it's in our economic interests. And clearly The Guardian have a place where scientists can respond to science reporting that they feel isn't really fair to, I guess, whatever they're doing. And she said there's a lot of studies that have proved that that the culling of badgers on a small scale reduces TB and
No. Reduces what, Emma?
No.
Come on, come on. What does it reduce?
Reduces.
She's looking very panic-stricken and scrambling through papers.
No, it is TB. It is TB. I was like, yeah, it's bovine TB. Suddenly I was like, that's tuberculosis. Yes, it is bovine TB, and it reduces that in cows, which is a big problem for our cows, apparently. So that's quite good, giving a balance. Like, someone can write something and then someone can write a response.
There's room for comeback in there.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's quite a good thing.
Okay, now we're going to take a slightly different perspective at this idea of publicising science results. So last week we heard from Dr. Paul Evans, who is the senior lecturer at the British Heart Foundation Cardiovascular Unit at Imperial College, and he was telling us about his study about this compound found in broccoli and how that can help prevent heart disease. Now, he went on to talk a little bit about his experience of trying to publicise fairly and clearly the results of his study. So let's hear what he had to say.
What do you think the problems are that a scientist encounters in communicating science to the public at large, particularly where experimental data are concerned?
Well, I think that communications to the public is important, but I also think that we need to be very careful about what aspects of our research we do communicate. I think there are a number of examples where studies have been communicated to the public too early, and then a subsequent study has not backed up those initial observations, and so then in that case the public gets misleading, conflicting information. So I think that scientists should publish their work in specialist journals in their field, but they should think very carefully about what is communicated, and they may not be the people who are best qualified to decide what should be communicated to the public. I think that when we published our study on broccoli, the British Heart Foundation and Imperial College were keen to communicate this to the public, and I worked with media relation officers from both organisations who were qualified in science and also in media studies, and they were very helpful. They were able to help me to condense the work into a lay subject to make sure that I didn't overstate any conclusions and to ensure that the public received a very clear message that was accurate. So when we went through that process, in general, it was a positive experience. We had headlines in one national UK paper. We had write-ups in 50 papers internationally. And in general, although the headlines may have overstated the study, the articles were generally accurate. But one paper got it completely wrong. One well-known UK national paper stated that consumption of broccoli lowers cholesterol, and we didn't show that. And they also stated that it does a better job in lowering cholesterol compared to statins. Now, this is potentially a very dangerous thing to present to the public. It's wrong, and many people take statins, which are an important drug, and if some of them were to stop taking their statins and instead buy broccoli from the local supermarket, this could have adverse effects on their health. So we were able to very quickly remove that article from the newspaper's website. So this is an example of how newspapers in general did a good job in reporting this piece of science, but one got it very wrong. And I think it emphasises that we need to be careful in what we communicate to the public, and we need to check how the journalists write up our science.
Dr. Evans, thank you very much indeed.
Now it's time for this week's Capsule Medicine.
So, as you may have gathered by now, we've been thinking about science reporting and media, and there is no science more emotive and more malleable to bad reporting than health news, like breakthroughs about potential new treatments for devastating diseases. And I've asked Elizabeth to tell us a bit about the body responsible for assessing these new breakthroughs.
That's right. Now, health headlines can be very emotive indeed, often causing many GP surgeries to fill with hopeful patients clutching cuttings from that morning's paper or indeed printouts from the internet. But individual doctors don't actually get any say in whether or not they can prescribe a new medication.
So is that all about funding because the NHS is in such a state?
Well, partly. Every time a new wonder drug or treatment concept like stem cells is discovered, it seems to be more expensive than the last treatment. And very few breakthroughs these days provide treatments as cost-effective as good old aspirin. So one aspect is that treatments are getting more expensive. Now, the second part of this is that as healthcare protects and maintains our population, there are just more people around to get sick. People are living longer, they're getting more complex illnesses, and they're requiring more technologically advanced treatments.
So just now you were talking about cost effectiveness, but that's not quite the same thing as just being cheap, is it?
No, you're right. In evaluating new treatments, it's not the actual expense of the product that's necessarily considered, but the actual cost effectiveness. And this is a very controversial area, which I'll come back to in a moment. But first off, let's think about the national body that was set up to make these evaluations and ultimately decisions about our life and death. So the body is called NICE, and that stands for the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence.
Well, that's a fancy name, but what do they actually do?
Well, NICE is the independent organisation responsible for providing national guidance on the promotion of good health and the prevention and treatment of ill health. So NICE produces guidance in three areas of health. So firstly, public health, and that means guidance on the promotion of good health and the prevention of ill health. Secondly, on health technologies. Now, that's guidance on the use of new and existing medicines, treatments and procedures within the NHS. And then thirdly, clinical practice. Now, that means guidance on the appropriate treatment and care of people with specific diseases and conditions, again, within the NHS.
So let's stick to evaluating new treatments for now. Where do they start?
Well, they look at the whole body of research concerning a particular drug or treatment. So it's important to note that NICE aren't actually anything to do with licensing the drug in the first place.
So that's making sure it's safe to use?
Exactly. All the treatments that NICE are evaluating have already been licensed, so they're known to be safe for use. So NICE is really looking at whether they are cost effective.
So back to cost effectiveness again.
Exactly. Now, this is a rather harsh and ugly idea. Now, they word it like this. Cost effectiveness is deciding which treatments to recommend and involves balancing the needs and wishes of individuals and the groups representing them against those of the wider population. This sometimes means that treatments are not recommended because they do not provide sufficient benefit to justify their cost.
So if something's quite expensive and helps people, it might not get used.
That's right. Now imagine you have a treatment and it's 90% effective, so it would cure 9 out of 10 people. But each treatment costs £1 million. Then you've got another treatment that would cure maybe 6 out of 10 people, but costs £10. Which treatment are you going to use?
I guess the £10 treatment.
Okay, now imagine that the £1 million treatment is for breast cancer and the £10 treatment is for backache. Which treatment would you back then?
Maybe the £1 million cancer treatment.
Why would you back that?
Well, because breast cancer can kill you and backache doesn't.
Okay, now in our imaginary world, let's imagine that breast cancer affects only 0.001% of the population and backache affects 10% of the population. Which are you going to back now?
So I can help 1 in 1,000 people or 1 in 10 people.
That's right. And the actual decisions that NICE are making are even more complex than that. So treatments rarely cure people. So often they're talking about a percentage improvement in quality or length of life for a percentage of the people on the treatment. And there are many, many, many treatments and conditions to weigh into the balance. And it is a balance. The NHS has a finite amount of money for treatments.
Well, that's a lot of maths and is really hard. So are doctors only allowed to prescribe things that have been recommended by NICE?
That's right. Only the treatments deemed cost-effective, on balance, giving enough health improvement to enough people, are recommended. And this is why many people who need a long-shot new cancer drug to perhaps lengthen their life by maybe 6 months are often disappointed. On an individual level, this is devastating and unfair. But on a population level, it's probably necessary to help as many people as possible.
Well, that's really, really, really interesting. But let's move on to whether you found anything in the news to do with all this health stuff.
Well, I did actually. There were two stories this morning regarding NICE and new treatment protocols. Now, the first one is the story that all hospital patients in England are to have their risk of suffering a potentially fatal blood clot assessed. So that means that every patient's going to have a blood clotting risk assessment when they get admitted to hospital. And this is all about preventing DVTs. And the risk with a DVT is that a bit of the clot can break off from the leg, where it's fairly safe, but travel up to the body, maybe lodge in the lungs, where it can cause devastating effects and even death. Now, the articles about this have been quite fair, and they've actually made the point that more people die from clot-related accidents where bits of clot break off and go to the lungs or whatever, than die from things like MRSA and Clostridium difficile, which is that horrible bug that a lot of old people suffer from in hospitals and unfortunately kills many people. So they've been quite balanced, and this is a nice recommendation, so it's going to go ahead and doctors will have to obey it. So that's one story. Now, the second story is about a new treatment for a condition called atrial fibrillation. Now, this is when the heart beats uncontrollably fast due to an abnormality in the top part of the heart, the atrium. There are many treatments for this condition, but there are a percentage of patients who, whatever treatment they're given, it doesn't help. They still have this problem. Their heart still beats irregularly. And the danger with this is that it can cause strokes and other serious side effects. Now, this new drug is a little bit expensive compared to the old drugs. So the old drugs cost maybe £1 for a whole month's worth of the drug.
Uh-huh. And How much does this one cost then?
Yeah, the new drug costs £2 a day.
Well, that's a lot more, isn't it?
So it doesn't sound like £2 doesn't sound like a lot. It's not like £1 million in our example.
That's like your morning latte, isn't it?
And so, yeah, so the papers are really playing to people saying £2 too expensive to save lives, you know.
Yeah.
£2 too much for you and you and you. But when you think about £1 a month or £2 a day, like you say, it's a big difference. And so NICE has actually said no to this drug. So these people that have the intractable atrial fibrillation, the atrial fibrillation that doesn't respond to treatment, are not going to be allowed to have this new drug, which could potentially stop them from having a life-threatening consequence to their condition. So it could potentially prevent them from having a stroke. It's controversial and whatever, but NICE has come down on the no side for that one. So that's the news from NICE in the papers this morning.
That is controversial. And if you have any questions or comments about this week's Capsule Medicine, please chuck an email our way at studio@shortscience.co.uk and we will do our best to answer your questions.
Now, we're continuing our 2010 quiz from last week. So after Emma's early lead, I fought back rather gallantly last week, I think, to draw level, with both of us now on 4 out of 6. So I'll kick off the questions, as usual. So question number one for Emma. In 2005, NICE joined with the Health Development Agency to become the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence. But when was NICE first established? Was it A, 1995... B, 1999, or C, 2003?
Wow, that's all quite recent. I don't know what they did before that. Right, yeah, they're all quite recent. It's going to be a guess. We had a change of government in 97, so it's a change thing. So maybe I'll go for 99.
That was very technically worked out. I think, yes, that's correct. It was 1999.
Yay.
So 1 point to Emma.
That's good. A bit of a fluke. Right, my question one. The Guardian runs a column called Bad Science, where science reporting is dissected by a certain chap, usually dismantling much of the hysteria around health scares, etc. What is his name? Is it A, Lord Drayson, B, Ben Goldacre, or C, Mark Henderson?
I'm afraid I know the answer to that one.
Yep. You'll either know it or you won't.
Yeah, it's Ben Goldacre.
It is indeed. Lord Drayson is the Minister for Science, apparently, and I've completely forgotten who Mark Henderson is. Sorry, Mark Henderson.
Probably somebody very important.
Probably.
Okay, so one apiece. Question two for Emma. In assessing cost effectiveness and other measures, NICE refers to something called a QALY, and that's QALY. So what is a QALY? Is it A, a quality adjusted life year? B, a quantity assured life yield, or C, a quantifiable accrued longevity yield?
Well, again, I don't really know. I'm thinking quality adjusted life years is both quality and length, as opposed to... So, yeah, I'm going to say quality adjusted life years.
And you would be correct.
Yay.
So, two to Emma.
Wow. Okay, right, my question two. Who is the new drugs advisor to the government since Professor David Nutt was sacked? Is the answer A, Professor David Nutt has been reinstated, B, Professor Jonathan Frank, or C, Professor Les Iverson?
Well, I don't think he's been reinstated, so I'll cross that one off. And no offence to people called Les, but it just doesn't sound, I don't know, doesn't sound right. So I'm going to go for Professor Jonathan Frank.
Well, Professor Les Iverson, the new drugs advisor. Oh. Apparently your name doesn't go with your job. Jonathan Frank I made up and then Googled. Apparently he is a professor in a university somewhere, but I just made up that name.
Oh, I'd heard of a Jonathan Frank. I don't know why. Well, many apologies to Les Iverson,
yes,
and good luck in the new job. Okay, so two to Emma and one to me, and we're coming on to Emma's third question. So one of NICE's more controversial decisions concerned the treatment memantine For which disease was this a treatment? Was it A, depression, B, renal cell carcinoma, or C, Alzheimer's?
Well, I don't actually know, but I do seem to recall in the last few years there was a big Alzheimer's controversy. So I am going to go for Alzheimer's, C.
You are correct. Ooh, there was also a big renal cell carcinoma controversy, but...
Clearly that went over my head and I remembered the right one.
Okay, so Emma's done very well and got 3 out of 3. I need to see if I can...
That's amazing.
...scrape another point here.
What have we got? You're in 1 out of 2.
Yeah.
So, number 3. At Christmas, a science lecture series is put on for the general public, which is usually televised. So, who puts on these lectures? Is it A, the Royal Society, B, the Royal Institution, or C, the Wellcome Trust?
Well, like all good daddies, my daddy made me watch these at Christmas.
So, very good.
I know. So I know that it's the Royal Institution.
That is indeed correct.
Woo! So I got 2 points. Woo! So the score is now 6 out of 9 to me and 7 out of 9 for Emma. So we'll pick up this battle again next week. But for now, it's time to announce the answer to last week's science trivia question, which was...
If red diamonds occur because of structural deformities in the mineral... and yellow and blue diamonds are due to nitrogen and boron impurities respectively, what are green diamonds due to?
And the answer was radiation. So well done to everyone who emailed in with that answer, including Brandy in America. So what is this week's question, Emma?
This week's question is, sticking to the precious metal theme, so where does the US government keep its supply of silver?
Interesting. Where would it keep its supply of silver? Well, if you know the answer, drop us an email to studio@shortscience.co.uk. Now, that's about all we've got time for today. But before we sign off, if you've got any comments or questions, don't forget to email us at studio@shortscience.co.uk. You can send in your suggestions for Capsule Medicine and Science and let us know if you'd like to be a guest on the show. You can also submit your profile if you'd like to be added to our website and have your very own capsule there for everyone to take a look at. So we really want to know what it's like for you to be working in science and what it is that's important or interesting about your science.
Yes, so the website is www.shortscience.co.uk. You can also listen again to the show from the Imperial College Radio website at www.icradio.com, and that will have the music. And tomorrow the podcast, Song Music, will be out and available for download. You can subscribe to us via iTunes. Just search for Short Science or follow the link from our website. Alternatively, you can subscribe with any number of podcatchers by following the subscribe link on our podcast page.
So, thank you very much for listening. This has been Short Science. Our guest today was Dr. Paul Evans, interviewed by Chrissy Douglas. The presenters were Emma Berger and myself, Elizabeth Hawke. The production was done by our own good selves, and the theme tune was written and produced by Don Gould of Music by Design.
Thanks for listening, and we'll be back at the same time next week for another episode of Short Science.
Stai ascoltando i podcast di Radio Bue, la web radio degli studenti dell'Università di Padova, www.radiobue.it.